Hello out there, my friends. This is Tim Binall of binallofamerica.com with another edition of Binall of America Audio. It is March 4th, 2006. We kick off March with Jerry E. Smith, part one of two. Jerry is the co-author of Secrets of the Holy Lance, The Spear of Destiny in History and Legend. And that is what we're discussing this week, the Spear of Destiny, also known as the Holy Lance or the Spear of Longinus. It is infamous in the esoteric world for its role in the Passion, and also recently its role in World War II. Jerry and his co-author George Picard have done an amazing job chronicling the journey of the spear from the Passion all the way up to World War II and post-World War II, and some of the controversies surrounding where it's been since then, and all the various rulers and factions that have had their hands on the spear in the 2,000 years in between. So that's what we're discussing in this lengthy interview with Jerry E. Smith. We bring you part one this week, which is the Spear of Longinus, its origins, the Passion, the story of the spear, relics in general, Longinus the man, where he went post-Passion, and then we trace the various folks who've had their hands on the spear leading up to Hitler, where we leave you off to wait till next week for the World War II portion of the spear discussion. So we cover a ton of ground this week, and of course there's tons more next week, but I'll preview that on the tail end of the interview. Here's a little bit about Jerry E. Smith for those of you who are unfamiliar with him. Jerry E. Smith has been a writer, editor, and activist for over three decades. He may be best known in the esoteric world for his book, Harp, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy. In 1991, Jerry Smith and Jim Keith, author of Black Helicopters Over America, Strike Force for the New World Order, and other numerous conspiracy and mind control books, founded the National UFO Museum, NUFOM, in Reno, Nevada. From 1991 to 1994, Jerry was the executive director of NUFOM, while Mr. Keith acted as the chairman of the board. In addition to his administrative duties running the day-to-day operations of NUFOM, Jerry also edited and wrote for that organization's quarterly journal, Notes from the Hangar. At the same time, Jerry worked as an editor, graphic artist for Jim Keith's magazine, Dharma Combat, the magazine of spirituality, reality, and other conspiracies. Jerry served variously as managing editor and art director from Dharma Combat's inception in 1988 until Jim's untimely death in 1999. Today, he lives and continues to write in Reno, Nevada. His websites are jerryesmith.com and secretsoftheholylance.com, which you can also get to by typing in spearbook.com. Without any further ado, let's kick it off. This interview was recorded on February 12, 2006. Jerry E. Smith, Part 1 of 2 on Binall of America Audio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Binall of America Audio. I want to welcome my guest this week, Jerry E. Smith. He's the co-author of Secrets of the Holy Lance. He's also written an awesome harp book. Hopefully he can tell us a little bit about that towards the end, but we're really here to talk about Secrets of the Holy Lance. Jerry E. Smith, for those of you who are uninformed, is a writer, editor, and activist for over three decades. His bibliography of published works includes scores of articles and reviews, over a dozen ghost-written books, and two non-fiction works from Adventures Unlimited Press. Harp, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, and this new book, Secrets of the Holy Lance, The Spear of Destiny in History and Legend. So welcome to the show, Jerry. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me.
First of all, why don't you just do a little bit of like a bio for yourself and how you got into the esoteric field in general, because you say you've been doing this for over three decades.
Right. Well, it goes back really to grade school. I started reading science fiction at age eight with Robert E. Heinlein's Have Spacesuit, Will Travel. Got involved in the zine scene in the 60s before it was the zine scene, back when it was still, all the zines were in science fiction fandom, and there were little literary magazines in those days. The zine scene of, what was it, the 70s, 80s, came out of science fiction fandom where I was back in the 60s. Did a bunch of zines, and at that time was working with Jim Keith, and Jim Keith and I did zines together in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, until Jim's death in 99. The last zine we did together was called Dharma Combat, the magazine of spirituality, reality, and other conspiracies.
Nice.
I've been, I think my first professional writing credit, again, goes to Jim. Jim Keith and Jim Schumacher were writing a book together, doing alternate chapters, and Jim was writing the last chapter, and half and I dropped into his house. This is, we're teenagers at the time.
Oh, wow.
I'm 16. The two Jims are both 17. And Jim's girlfriend, Carla, shows up, and Jim had been having trouble figuring out the end of the book, and I had made some suggestions. Carla shows up and he says, okay, you finish the book. He leaves with her and I finish the book.
Oh, man.
I have long since lost track of how many books I've written, because most of them don't have my name on it. I did a lot of ghostwritten and manuscript correction where guys who had a good idea but really couldn't write would come to me and I'd clean up their manuscripts. And some of them sold and some of them didn't, and some of them I'm not quite sure which ones were which, you know. So I think altogether I worked on about 40 books,
of which
about 12 of them were written wholly by me.
And did he span like the whole range of esoteric topics, or was he like mainstream type books, or what?
A variety of things. I tried getting into fiction, so I've written a couple of science fiction books and a western and some mainstream, and I even tried I wrote a romance. That's the word I'm looking for. Just dabbling at it, and then I got into nonfiction and really, really hit my stride with nonfiction. And unfortunately, my first nonfiction book still hasn't sold.
Oh, man.
I wrote it on spec, and that was the last book I've written on speculation. You know, if you're a home builder, you can build a home on spec and pretty much assume sooner or later you're going to sell it. You write a book on spec and sometimes it just sits in your filing cabinet for the next decade or two.
Yeah.
And so that book was Toppling the Pyramid, A Practical Guide to Overthrowing the New World Order.
I can see maybe why it hasn't been printed yet.
Yeah.
We're keeping it down.
So my next book was HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, and I cannibalized a lot of stuff out of Toppling to go in HARP. My book about HARP is not about how HARP works. It's about if HARP works, who would want to do that. It's about the politics, the geopolitical politics around the coming global government that I use as the focus of the book. And it's just HARP, it has a potential to be used, or electromagnetic technologies, radio technologies have a potential to be used by those folks to further their end. So that's what that book's about. And then the most recent one is Secrets of the Holy Lands. This came out last July. The way that one happened was my publisher is Adventures Unlimited Press, David Hector Childress, and David sells a lot of books in his catalog that he didn't publish. The publishing house has been in existence for 22, 23 years, and he's published about 150 titles during that 20-year run, but he's also sold thousands of other titles.
Yeah.
And a couple of titles in his catalog that were selling rather briskly for him were the two books by Colonel Howard Buchner, Hitler's Ashes and Adolf Hitler and Secrets of the Holy Lands. And also Trevor Ravenscroft's The Spear of Destiny, and his follow-up book, The Cup of Destiny, and Mark of the Beast. And so my publisher, David Hector Childress, got this bright idea that if he had a book on the subject that he published, then he wouldn't have to sell those books, and instead of making pennies per book, he'd make dollars per book.
Yeah.
So he gave me a call last summer, and at that time I was working on the book I'm currently working on, which is Chemtrails, HARP, and Weather Warfare, the Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature.
Oh, nice.
And I was about 6 months into that book, and David gave me a call and said, hey, the Spirit Destiny is a cute selling thing. Can you write me a book on the subject? I had read Trevor Ravenscroft back when it came out in the early 70s, and I had a lot of interest in the subject, and I had been, 15 years ago, I had been researching whether or not Hitler really died in the bunker, and that got me into researching Nazi disc aircraft, and that led to my becoming the executive director of the National UFO Museum in the early 90s. What had happened was I had discovered that there was very good evidence that the Nazis had, in fact, built disc aircraft. And one day, Jim Keith and a buddy of ours known as Crazy Larry were sitting around in my office, and we're talking about this, and Crazy Larry starts going, hey, I could build one of those. You give me the plans, and I'll build one. I go, okay, well, you know, the plan's got to be somewhere. So my first thought was there must be a UFO museum somewhere in the world, and I'll just write them and get the plans. Well, of course, there wasn't one.
Yeah.
So being a do-it-yourselfer from way back, I started one. It was this is in Reno, Nevada. And in Reno, there were a bunch of other museums that were the national this, that, or the other. There's the National Automobile Museum, the National Championship Air Race Museum, a number of these national museums. So I decided that we should just join the club, and we were the National UFO Museum. Well, some old-time ufologists in Roswell, New Mexico, decided to start their museum, and they decided they had to one-up us. So they're the International UFO Museum. So I say to David, okay, yeah, I know quite a bit about some aspects of this subject. I'd be happy to write a book about it. And he goes, okay, fine, I want it in 2 months.
Oh, man.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it took me 2 years to write the HARP book.
Oh, wow.
My friend George Picard also lives in Reno, and George had a book through David Hector Childress, Adventures Unlimited Press. George's book was about Operation Paperclip, which brought Nazi spy masters and rocket scientists to the U.S. at the end of World War II, and led to the creation of NASA and CIA, which may have led to what looks today like the Fourth Reich. And so I'm looking at the Spear book and thinking, well, you know, this is a good area. You know, the Nazi connection to the Spear was huge. Adolf Hitler, it was the center of Trevor Ravenscroft's book. So I thought, you know, if George should definitely be on this, so I give George a call and ask him if he wants to write a book. And he's thinking, you know, it's been several years since his book is Liquid Conspiracy, JFK, LSD, the CIA, Area 51, and UFOs. And so we're both on the same page on a number of subjects here. And he was thinking it's been a number of years since his book came out, and it would look good in his resume to have another book. So he goes, okay, sure, what the heck, yeah, I'll help. And so we split the book up into George wrote most of the Nazi stuff, and I wrote most of everything else. And it was hilarious in that we each started by first drafting our section and then passing it over to the other.
Yeah.
And George would write his chapters and pass them to me, and I'd add to them. I'd write my chapters, pass it to George, and he'd subtract from them.
Well, let me ask you a technical question, I guess, because I had never seen this before in a book that I'd read. You started with chapter zero.
Right. The HARP book starts with chapter zero, and then I decided to continue it. Actually, George and I the Spear book ends with chapter double zero.
Yeah, that was
so
the next thing, yeah.
It's odd and double odd.
Yeah.
As in buckshot.
Is that like a stylistic choice?
Yeah, it was. It was very much so. It got started with the HARP book in that I wrote a chapter one for the HARP book, and people kept complaining. I mean, when I was passing it around to readers before I sent it to the publisher, they were saying that it wasn't grabby enough, that I had to write a grabby introduction. So I wrote another first chapter and put it in front of chapter one, so that it had to be chapter zero.
Yeah.
So then what we decided to do with the Spear book is that each chapter begins with a dramatization. Each chapter has a little section in italics at the beginning of the chapter that takes a scene from the chapter and dramatizes it. And so we decided, well, what we're going to do is we're going to do that with every chapter and with the book. So the book begins with a dramatization of a scene from the end of the book. So the book begins and ends with chapter 000, which is also what may be the most important moment in the history of the Spear, which is it's claimed that the Spear of Destiny was hidden in Antarctica and reclaimed in 1979. So the book begins and ends with the Spear being reclaimed in 1979, because if that's true, then the Spear is not an object hidden in a museum, or, you know, not hidden in a church, not on display in a museum, but is actually in somebody's hands being used as a real player on the world stage.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was a really cool effect. I, like I said, I'd never seen that before. And also on the cover of the book, now this is what would be considered the Spear today, the mainstream, if you wanted to go see the Spear, that's what you'd see, the one that's on the cover?
Right, the one that's on the cover is the one that's in the museum in Vienna. And there are numerous objects around the world claiming to be the Spear. And I'm sure we'll get to that.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask that, because as I'm reading the book, I keep flipping back to the cover to sort of, picture it in my mind. So it's cool to know that I wasn't wrong.
Right, and what you see there is an old spearhead, and in the middle of it is a gold sheath. And if you look very closely, you can see that there is a pin or a nail attached to the spearhead, and is kind of woven into the spearhead, laced in with wire that's silver wire holding in a nail that supposedly is a nail from Jesus's cross.
And then it would, now you say that's the spearhead, so that would attach to like a long staff.
A long staff. It would have been about it was reported as being twice a man's height.
Oh, wow.
So the spear shaft itself, the shaft would have been, 10, 12 feet.
And how long is the spearhead?
I think it's something like 18 or 23 inches. I don't remember offhand. I'm really, really miserable with remembering numbers.
So it's like a foot and a half to 2 feet.
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay. So it's not like two, it's not like, it's much bigger than on the cover of the book.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, now...
If you saw the movie Constantine, the Spear is one of the major characters in the movie, and the very first thing you see is the Spear being discovered or found in Mexico wrapped in a Nazi flag, and you can see that the one he's holding is only about 17, 18 inches long.
Yeah.
And that replica that's used in the movie is just beautiful. It is spectacular. And there are replicas like it on sale on eBay, and you can own your own replica.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, just getting into the book here, we start out with relics in general, because that's really what the Holy Lance is, Spear of Destiny is. It's a relic. So why don't you tell us about what relics are? And just the general concept of relics and where they come from.
Great. Again, the for those who are unfamiliar with it, this is the spear that supposedly pierced the side of Christ as he hung on the cross. This makes it a relic of the Passion and a relic of Jesus. And the concept of relics is common in virtually every religion. Hindus, Muslims, Jews, Christians, Buddhists, all have a reverence for relics, and it's more than just a reverence. It's more than, the thing is not just a memento or a keepsake because somebody famous used it, and you look at this thing and remember that somebody. But it's believed that the saints, the prophets, the gods were supernatural, and that the relic, because it was directly physically associated with the prophet, the saint, or God, it has it has itself been imbued with the supernatural. The idea is that the natural world that we live in is subservient to, is less important a world than the spiritual world. The supernatural is the real universe. You know, if we are indeed imperishable, immortal spirits, we live in the supernatural world, and the world of our senses, the natural world, is a passing fancy, something we're only going to see for 50 or 100 years, and then spend the rest of eternity on the other side. So the idea is that the other side is always leaking through to this side, that the supernatural has an ongoing daily impact on us. Indeed, many surveys over the last few years have shown that the majority of Americans, something like 95-98%, believe in the God of the Bible. 85-90% believe in angels. 75-85% believe in demons. Americans believe as their great-great-grandparents have believed, as their great-great-great-grandparents had believed, that there is a spiritual world, and the spirits move among us and do things. And part of this is shown in the relics. And in Catholicism, there are three classes of relic. A first-class relic is something that was actually physically a part of the saint or prophet, such as a bone or a hank of hair.
Yeah.
And then the second stage or second-class relic is something associated with that entity, such as a sandal. And the third-class relic is something that is brought to the shrine and is touched to the higher class relic.
Yep.
Such as when the Spear of Destiny was on display in Nuremberg in the 1500s, Queen Isabella of Spain sent a piece of muslin to be pierced by the spear in hopes of making it a third class relic.
Okay, now, like, what are some of the examples of these relics outside of the more famous Spear of Destiny and
well, there's the crown of the crown of thorns. The Shroud of Turin is probably the most famous relic of the Passion.
Yeah.
But it's also believed that the crown of thorns existed, and that there are about 70 thorns from the crown of thorns scattered around Europe in various churches and synagogue or churches and what chapels.
Yeah.
And then there are pieces of the True Cross. It's believed that the pieces of the True Cross are around. In fact, it was quite a little cottage industry for a while, to the point where a famous priest 500 years ago once commented that there were so many pieces of the True Cross that you could build a boat from them.
Now, do you think all these, now it seems like what you just said, there were a lot of relics back in the day. Are there a lot of relics still around today, or is it sort of faded into obscurity relatively because of, you know, skepticism of people in general?
You know, I would say that it virtually, any Buddhist temple you go to is built around a chamber for holding relics called a stupa. In fact, usually the way it goes is they build the stupa and then they build the temple around it.
Oh, wow.
Most Christian churches in America are relic-less, simply because, you know, the relics didn't get here.
Yeah.
But you go to Europe, and the overwhelming number of churches in Europe have a reliquary somewhere in it, and a piece of Saint Anne, or a bit of John the Baptist, or a bit of this, a bit of that.
Yeah.
They're particularly it seems to be pretty much universal throughout Europe, East and West. I don't know how much people still venerate the relics, but they are definitely there. And, you know, the argument over some of these just doesn't go away, such as the Shroud of Turin.
Yeah. And now, moving on to the Holy Lance, why don't you go a little in-depth about what the Holy Lance was, and like you said, it was the lance that pierced the side of Christ.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about that.
What we know from the Bible is it's mentioned in four places in the New Testament, most prominently in John, where it's telling the story of the crucifixion, and that what we know is that crucifixion is a particularly gruesome way to die. As long as you can keep pushing up with your legs, you can stay alive, because the way you die is you don't bleed to death, you don't have serious injuries. What you have is your own weight on your arms, and once your full weight is on your arms in crucifixion, the chest muscles are constricted, and you suffocate, you strangle yourself to death. So as long as you keep pushing up, keep pulling the weight off of your arms, you can stay alive. So it takes many hours. The common crucifixion is 12, 15 hours. And this is 12 hours of hanging there in pain, knowing you're going to die soon, and that you're just, and so you end up being exhausted both mentally and spiritually as well as physically by the time you finally give up and just can't push another time and end it all.
Yeah.
Jesus's crucifixion was scheduled on Friday before Passover, and that's a violation of several Jewish laws that there cannot be. If a man is put on a tree, he cannot be on the tree on the Sabbath. He cannot be killed on the Sabbath. He cannot be buried on the Sabbath. So they had to have him dead and down before sunset, because the Sabbath starts at sunset on Friday,
yeah,
and lasts until Saturday, where it's dark enough to see three stars. As the day wore on, and Jesus and the two common criminals he was crucified with showed no signs of dying anytime soon, the priests went to Pilate and asked Pilate to send some soldiers around to break the legs. With the legs broken, they can't push up and they'll die.
Yeah.
So the soldiers went to the two common criminals first and broke their legs, and then came to break Jesus. Now, at that point, a centurion steps forward and pierces the body with his spear, showing that Jesus was already dead and so wouldn't need his legs broken.
Yeah.
Now, that's what's covered in the New Testament. Also, it mentions that when the body was pierced, out came the water and blood. Now, in the Apocrypha, in some of the books that have been taken out of the Bible,
yeah,
such as the Gospel of Nicodemus, also known as the Acts of Pilate, it tells us a great deal more about this centurion. Supposedly his name was Gaius Cassius Longinus. Gaius Cassius Longinus was elderly and going blind, and had spent his entire life in the service of Caesar, and was sent to Judea, and then put on light duty, and they taken him off of having to do the military grunt work, and put him on what is essentially an intelligence gathering mission. You might call it Red Squad.
Yeah.
He was sent to follow Christ around and report back on what this agitating leader was doing. And in the process of doing this, he heard many of Christ's sermons, may have seen some of the miracles, yada yada, and may well have come to, if not be a believer, be teetering on becoming a believer.
Yeah.
The breaking of the bones is an act of ignominy. It's something you do only to somebody you hate. And so when when uh, the soldiers came to break Christ's bones, the centurion, Gaius Cassius Longinus, was struck with, you know, I don't want to see that happen to this guy. He deserves better. And went up and showed them, you don't have to do this guy in because he's already dead.
Yes.
Now, the story goes that when he did that, the blood and lymph came out, or the blood and water came out, and splashed in his eyes, and instantly cured his blindness, at which point he became a Christian.
Yeah.
Now the numerous objects that are claimed. Oh, I forgot one important point. It has since become a legend that whoever possesses his holy lance and understands the powers it serves holds in his hand the destiny of the world for good or evil.
Yes, that's the big. That's
why it's called the Spear of Destiny, exactly. So, it's also called the Spear of Christ, the Spear of Longinus, and yada yada.
Yeah.
There are several objects that claim to be it, and the reason is because there is several stories as to what happened to Longinus after the crucifixion. One of the stories is that he went east, following in the footsteps of Paul, and ended up in or around Armenia. And there is today a spear or an object in a church in Armenia that they claim is his spear. The problem is that everybody who's looked at it says it's not a spear. It's a standard head. It's a flagpole top.
Yeah.
It's shaped like a spear. That kind of lets that one out. Let's see. Then there's also the story that he never left the Holy Land, that at becoming a Christian, he was then persecuted for being a Christian and got himself arrested and put to death with the other Christians there in the Holy Land, and that his spear stayed there. A spear reported to be his spear was on display in Jerusalem up until about the 6th century. Around the 4th century or 5th century, it got broken, and the tip of it got broken off. And the tip was given to a king who took it back to what is now France. And that spear head tip remained on display until the French Revolution, where it vanished.
Okay.
The body of the spearhead was last seen in Jerusalem about 640 AD, and then Jerusalem was overrun by the Muslims. And it turns up again in the 1400s. And the way it turns up is the caliph, the leader of all the Muslim world, dies, leaving two sons and no clear heir. And the two sons have a battle, a war between each other over who's going to end up ruling the Muslim world.
Yeah.
And one son wins and one son loses. And the losing son bugs out and goes to the Templar Knights, who are also the Knights Hostiller of St. John. And because they are the Hostillers, they give him hospitality.
Yeah.
And they put him up for a while. And then they decide, you know, this guy would be better with the Pope. And they send him off to the Vatican. Now, the winning brother realizes that the losing brother knows all kinds of stuff about him.
Yeah.
And that it would be really good if the Pope didn't learn all this stuff about you know, their
empire.
Yeah, right. So the winning brother, and I'm not saying their names because I cannot pronounce them.
That's okay.
You know, the losing brother's name is usually spelled C-I-Z.
Oh man,
yeah, in most books the C has got a accent grove at the top and the Z has got a thingy at the bottom, and I have no idea how to pronounce that.
Exactly.
So the winning brother offers to buy the losing brother from the Pope and offers an obscene amount of money, just a piles of gold,
yeah,
and the Holy Lands. So the Pope trades in the losing brother who dies almost immediately, and ends up filthy rich. Or I'm sure he already was filthy rich, but he gets a whole lot richer. And the Spear of Destiny, or the Spear of Longinus, moves to the Vatican and stays in the Vatican, and it's there now. From what I've read, the object about 100 or 200 years ago was built into, walled up inside a decorative structure that holds up a roof over one of the Pope's thrones.
Oh, wow.
Apparently, there's like four posts to hold up this roof, and there's some Christian magic item in each of the four posts. And one of which being the sphere of Longinus.
Yeah.
Now, the Catholic Church admits, yeah, we have it, and what's it to you? They do not make any claims about it. They do not say it is. They do not say it ain't. They just say, yeah, we got it.
Yeah.
And then there is the story that Longinus went north. And this is the story we cover in our book, Secrets of the Holy Lands, is that... Remember, Christ could not be killed on the Sabbath, nor could he be buried on the Sabbath. And so Joseph of Arimathea claims the body and puts it in his own tomb, which gets Joseph in Dutch with the Jewish Sanhedrin. The Jewish state was a theocracy. The civil government and the religion were one and the same. And so he gets in trouble with the priests and ends up leaving. And the story is that he was a tin trader, and the tin came from Great Britain or from the British Isles. So he and Longinus go to Britain, and he forms believed that he was part of creating Glastonbury Abbey, and the Longinus' spear may have moved after Longinus to Queen Boadicea, who led an uprising. And this is where the myth really starts to crank in, is that Queen Boadicea slaughtered at least 25,000 Romans. As long as she had the spear, she was invincible. The Romans only won because they took her, they attacked her at night while she was sleeping, and didn't have a chance to use it properly in battle against them. This belief that the spear makes its claimant invincible is repeated throughout the next 2,000 years. And there are many times where it does indeed seem to make its owner invincible. Charlemagne, 800 years later, has the spear, and Charlemagne not only wins every battle, but says the spear did it. And indeed, here we see. I know I'm jumping the story a little bit here, but this ties in with this whole. Legend of the spear is that the legend of the spear includes all these supernatural phenomena that occur around it. Probably the most famous of which is Constantine's vision, and I know we'll get to that in a moment. But Charlemagne seems to have what in today's terms would be precognizance. He said that with the spear, before a battle, he saw how the battle was going to go. The spear showed him the battle, showed him how to win the battle, and so with this precognitive knowledge, he won 49 out of 49 battles.
Oh, wow.